Hello, everyone, and welcome back for another Meet the Hashtag Booligans episode. I'm your minimally qualified host. My name is Daniel, and you can follow me on Twitter at @D_Twit, and you can follow this here podcast on Twitter and Facebook at @BooligansPod. Dedicated listeners might have noticed that there was a bit of a lull between our last episode and this one. I promise you, it was not laziness or inertia that has set in. We had a house guest for 2 weeks, and upon his departure, I found myself with a particularly juicy head cold. You know, one of those head colds, the ones that leave you leaking everywhere, and then your voice starts sounding sequentially like every character in The Muppet Show, usually starting with Kermit, and then Animal, and then Gonzo, and finally Fozzie Bear. I hope that by now you can't hear it as much anymore, but it was pretty out there. So that was the last week over here at Casa Twit. And since I don't plan on infecting any of you with whatever the hell I got myself into, let's get to meeting and enjoying two wonderful and really prolific Pooligans whose names you're all likely very familiar with right after this outstanding bumper.
Yeah, I do have a question.
You have a question? Yeah. Okay, that is always good. Yes, please go ahead.
Because this is my very first podcast, you know, is there anything that I particularly need to know? I mean, like, is there a certain structure around how you want to ask us questions? And
Well, Nancy, have you listened to any of the other podcasts?
Have listened to them, and I'm very impressed, actually.
Thank you. No, I was not fishing for compliments. No, I was asking because of the structural question.
Right.
So you sort of know that we do the questionnaire.
Yes.
And then we'll do some free range questions. We can do travel. We cannot do history because Bubbles is not here and I'm a poor student of history. So that would just be the two of you talking amongst yourselves, which I'm also okay with. But I'm just saying I'm not your man for American history trivia, unfortunately. I would lose.
Bubbles is actually a historian, is he not?
Isn't he a history professor? I think he is.
He is a professor. He is a professor of history, and hence he would be fully qualified to join your historical debate. I, on the other hand, studied film in college, and with that completely useless skill, am not at all equipped for your history discussion.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
It's still more college than I ever did.
Well, in that case, college didn't even work as an excuse. Now I'm fucked. Okay, I'm just plain ignorant, actually, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So glad we established that. I will cut that out of this podcast. Yes, Nancy, in order to answer your question, Daniel has no excuse for his complete ignorance of history at all. And there will be a questionnaire, and then there will be free range questions. You are completely allowed to curse. I suggest that you have some water handy.
The best part is there's no camera, so I can't pull a Rubio.
Yeah, none of that. No. You can drink your water in as visually an unpleasing way as you wish. You do not have to look cool during this podcast. Our friend Bubbles has famously once told us that he was not even wearing pants. So,
all right, I think that's TMI.
Well, now, see, I told you there's no rules on this podcast. So unfortunately, I had told him that as well. And that is how I found out his state of dress. Here we go. We are doing a Meet the Pooligans episode, as you've already heard in the intro. And today I have two much anticipated guests, one of them long anticipated, and the other one a more recent addition to the canon. You are familiar because of the way that Julie says his name every time he tweets something at her. You are familiar with our first friend. His name is Dennis Levesque. You can follow him at a very original Twitter handle. I'm always so fucking jealous. Okay. You can follow him at @Dinosaur.
Yes.
And when I say sore, I don't mean like the bruise kind. It's @DENISAUR. So this is actually a form of dinosaur.
Yes.
A Canadian dinosaur, I take it.
Yes. And it has a very not safe for work backstory.
Oh, great. So we will hear that shortly. And our second guest is the long anticipated one. I worked on her for, I think, going on probably a year. And we have finally, she has decided that now I guess I've proven my mettle with this here podcast. And she has finally joined us, which of course I'm extremely delighted by. She is, and you've heard her name many times on the Bonus Press Pool, Nancy J. You can follow her at Nardween, N-A-R-D-W-I-E-N. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Daniel. How are you?
Good. So glad to finally have you. I'm excited.
Me too. I am excited.
That was the most excited reaction ever and seemed completely genuine. Okay, so since Dennis already told us that he has a TMI story about his nickname, we are going to have to, of course, immediately find that out. Nancy, I apologize. Dennis, how did your name come about?
Well, in high school, my buddy was my best friend. He was dating this girl, and they decided that I needed a new nickname.
What was your old nickname?
My old nickname at that point is Hoffman, because I was constantly riding a BMX bike and talking about Matt Hoffman. Mm-hmm. So they decided I needed a new one. And the very first thing she came up with was Penisaur, because I was very chatty, you could say, with the ladies, and she decided that that was an appropriate way to name me. And I was like, well, I can't be called that in public. We need something better than that. So then I just said, fine, Dinosaur the Penisaur.
So we welcome you, Dinosaur the Penisaur, to this here podcast. I think that is as good as a start that as we've ever had to the question, how did your Twitter handle come about? I think that is fantastic. Nancy, are you okay? Are you still here?
Yeah, I'm still here. No, I haven't left yet.
I'm glad. We just had to make sure that we haven't already scared Nancy away, not 5 minutes into the podcast. As you know, we always start this Meet the Pooligans episodes with our questionnaire, which is what we're going to do right now. And we'll start with Nancy. Nancy, tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, and what you do, anything that you're comfortable sharing.
Okay. So I was actually born in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, but I grew up in Florida. And I was married. Julie has mentioned my marriages a couple of times on the air. I was married when I was very young, and I had 4 children. And then I divorced that husband, got married again, and had one more son. So I have 5 sons. And I went back to college when my children were pretty much like, I think the youngest one was in elementary school. And I just kept going. I went like 12 years straight and got a bachelor's and then 2 master's degrees. And then I got a doctoral degree in human development. And I have my own consulting business, and I teach online with doctoral students, which is one of the things I love to do. But my consulting business, I work with organizations to help them be more effective, help them understand each other better. So learning about their, like team building, those kinds of things. So I do that kind of work. And I actually worked for NASA for 5 years as a consultant, which I love doing. NASA is a really cool place to work. And how did I, did you want to know, you said not necessarily how I came to be interested in politics, but.
No, we can do that now. Although I'm sorry, I'm stuck on somebody having 5 sons. So we're going to have to. We're going to have a quick discussion about what it's like to have 5 sons, because I find that an incredible statistic. Were you averse to daughters, or did it not happen?
Everybody always thinks that I was trying to have a daughter, and I always say I wasn't trying to do anything. This is just the way it worked out. Right. I actually had my 3 oldest were all in diapers at the same time. So there's only 2 years between my oldest and my 3rd child. So they're pretty rambunctious having boys. There's a special kind of synergy that happens. It's like because they provoke each other and help each other. And for a long time, I felt like I was kind of overburdened, like, oh, you know, I have these five sons and I, people who only have one, they don't know. But I came to realize that I tell people, it doesn't matter how many children you have. If you only have one, they're going to take up 100% of your time. It doesn't really matter. So I, you know, having them was kind of fun. And I didn't have any daughters, you know. But now I have granddaughters that I adore, and my I always have to try to count in my head. I have like 14 grandchildren, and I have 2 great grandchildren.
Wow, that is a that is a Christmas to remember right there. Does everybody get together on the holidays?
I think I would have said, luckily, no, we don't. Yeah.
Do they have to take turns? Do they win lottery tickets of who gets to visit grandma?
Yeah, something like that. But, you know, it's I came from a very large family. There were 7 children in my family, and I always I always thought, wow, everybody getting together and having these big Thanksgiving, big Christmas, you know, that's what you should do. But now, as I get older, I find that I really like that they come and visit me kind of one-on-one. You know, it really is a lot, you know, more quality time that I have with them. So we don't have big events very often. And in fact, I have a big birthday this year, and we're going to Disney World, and pretty much two of my granddaughters are coming. My children are not coming at all. And one of my nephews is coming. I was like, okay, I don't even understand that.
Wow. How did you convince some of the other children that were clearly at a Disney World age that they should stay home?
Well, yeah, I didn't convince anybody. You know, it was an open invitation. So it's whoever is available to, you know, to come. So they haven't finalized all their plans. But, you know, I didn't put that down as one of my hobbies, but I actually love Disney. I've been there many times, and I think I was there the first year it opened. So
we will have a Disneyland discussion at the end of this. This is the best thing that has ever happened to me.
Well, I'm happy for
this
you.
This is fantastic. I am happy for me too, yeah. Nancy. This is so great. Okay, sorry, I got a little bit overexcited there for a second. Dennis, over to you, sir. Tell us about your background, about your likes, and hopefully you've been to Disney World, because otherwise the tail end of this is going to be a bit boring for you.
All right. I was born and raised in southwestern Ontario in Canada. You know, it's a little bit colder up here, but we managed to get by. I grew up in a household with both my parents being union members. I got into politics, as gruesome as it is, on 9/11. Before that, there's always a newspaper on the table, and I, you know, was just a kid at the time, but I would pick up the paper, read through it in bits and pieces, and that day, the school was very mum. There wasn't a lot of noise at school that day, and everyone was pretty quiet, and the teachers were constantly just out in the hall. Finally, everybody got sent home. I got home. My mom was sitting on the front porch, just crying her face off. Me and my brother walk up, and she gives us both a giant hug, and we're confused because they didn't tell us at school what had happened. And my mom tells us that, you know, something really bad has happened. So go inside, turn on the news, and I sat there for the next 2 days and just watching CNN and CBC, and it really opened my mind to what is going on out there. And then from that, it just grew into a love of politics and history and different places.
You know, that's the first time that we've had a 9/11 story that for somebody was formative, and well, formative at a young age, I should say. Can I ask how old you are now?
I'm 29 now, so I was 11 when it happened.
Yeah, I think that is something that people generally forget about millennials, is that some of you grew up right during that period and the impact that that moment had.
Oh, it was a huge moment for me, and it was you couldn't escape it. Like, even in Canada, everything was closed, and I'm a truck driver. My father, he drives a truck, and it's a common theme among men in my family. But like that day, we got home, and then that was after we found out what happened. That was the first question: was, well, where's Dad? Because we were told, you know, they shut down the border, and it's like, oh no, is he on the other side? Is he in Canada? Because this was before cell phones, really. So it was like, uh-oh, where is he? So we just had to sit around and wait to see if he came home that day or if he was stuck in the U.S. Thankfully, he was running late that day, and he never made it across the border. So he got home that night and everything for us. But yeah, that was a very, very stressful day.
Yeah, it sure was. But it seems like it formed your interest in politics. So we will get back to that in just a second. Nancy, tell us really quickly, what formed your interest in, or can you pinpoint your interest in politics to a particular event, or was that something that you came to later in life? How did you come to politics?
Well, I think it was it's sort of like two phases, because the first was I was I'm old enough to have been part of the discussion of changing when people voted, you know, because when I was younger, you had to be 21 to vote in the United States. And so I can remember having those discussions in school about how, you know, people were saying, well, you know, if you're 18, you're too young. And I was like, well, I don't know very much about politics, but if I had the vote, I would learn more about politics. And then I think I sort of took a hiatus raising my children. I didn't give it much attention. But the one thing that I'm the most, you know, passionate about when it comes to politics in the United States is the vote, you know, and having people being able to exercise their right to vote. And I really, you know, in the presidential, you know, the last presidential election, I actually registered people to vote and, you know, and was a poll watcher and did things like that. So I think particularly the last election, because of the neighborhood or the community that I lived in, I just got much more interested in it. And I know that, you know, because this is the Pooligans podcast, you know, I do have to say that Julie Mason did, you know, help form my current perspective of politics. I think, you know, she's the right person, because I feel very strongly that I don't want to be labeled one thing or another. You know, when it comes to my political views, I can see many sides of things. And so I try to take that perspective, you know, and I have a lot of liberal friends. I fight them too, because I tell them when they're wrong. So it's not just on the other side.
So if you have to explain to people where you find yourself currently on the political spectrum, you would consider yourself somewhere in the middle, or how would you describe your politics right now as we sit here?
Yeah, it's funny, because I think it depends on what the particular issue is, because I think I can have some, you know, fairly conservative views of some things. But I think when it comes to particularly social issues, I would put myself on the side of being liberal and, you know, progressive. But I guess I just still wanted to add in there that I want to have conversations about those things, you know, because I'm not like, I do have certain values that I won't move off of, but I actually want to hear other people's perspectives too.
Dennis, where would you consider yourself in your politics? Now, you're up in Canada, obviously, so you're not voting down in the United States, but where would you consider yourself on the political spectrum?
It's really hard to say. There's my viewpoint is very different in most parts. I am a bit of a communist. It's hard to be a bit of a communist, but I am. So I'm very much out, you know, my whole stance on the economic structure of the West is that it's inferior and needs to be changed. But I understand that in attempts to do that have failed for very good reasons, because it's the move to communism is not an easy one, and I don't have any answer for that, which is why I don't actually support the Communist Party in Canada. But for American politics of it, I'd actually probably end up voting Republican more often than Democrat is the easiest way to say it.
Now, what is it that makes you say that you would rather vote for Republicans than for Democrats if you, on the other hand, are also for communism? That would seem to be slightly at odds, no?
It is at odds, but we don't live in a communist society in the West. In all practicality, we live in a very capitalistic society, and for the governments to run effectively, I believe that you cannot run massive deficits and debts, and between the two, that's the priority that goes that way, and money is the biggest issue to me, so I'd probably end up voting for them a lot more, but it'd be very hard to vote for some of the very social conservative ones, because it's that stuff just boils my blood a little.
Mm-hmm. So you would be in a hard place right now voting in the United States. What is it like voting in Canada? What side of the fence do you fall on there?
Well, so far I've been able to participate in 3 federal elections. I've voted for the Conservative Party twice, the New Democratic Party once, which is the... it's pretty far left, but provincially I've voted for conservatives, and I tend to vote for conservatives just because of the budget. And voting in Canada, it's pretty well the same. We have a few more parties to deal with. In my hometown, actually, in London, Ontario, I got to vote with a ranked ballot for the first time instead of a first-past-the-post system. And I have to say, it was the happiest I've ever been. And I really wish my prime minister had lived up to his promise of introducing a ranked ballot, because it just made me feel so much better about casting my vote for someone.
Very, very interesting. So I'll have some questions for you later about how fiscally conservative parties like the Republicans are actually against a steeper deficit, because right now in America, that's absolutely not what's happening. But we'll talk about that a little later. At the moment, every kind of deficit seems to be super okay.
That's the problem here in Canada, too. Whenever the Conservatives come in, you know, they run, albeit lower deficits, they still run them. And it is super, super annoying, because right now in Canada, we're up to 37 cents, I think it is, on every dollar just goes to paying the interest on the debt. And that's 37 cents that we could use to be tackling more important issues if we had been responsible in the past. So it is a very frustrating thing when people don't want to deal with it.
Mm. Yeah, no, here in America, we just keep piling on more debt, and nobody's really talking about how to pay it back at the moment at all.
Yeah.
At all. We're slashing the taxes and more deficit. So that seems to be the current trajectory, and the GOP is suddenly totally okay with that.
Yeah, it's funny how they fall silent whenever they have total control about deficits. All of a sudden, you know, you can't get them to talk about it. But the moment a Democrat has any power,
it's hysterical to me, because, you know, when you look at this at statistically, when the Democrats have been in power, they've almost always had more balanced budgets, more, you know. The way that they ran the government, it was actually less deficit, even though they seem to have the reputation of being the, you know, big spenders, when Reagan was a huge spender. You know what I mean? Like the other Republicans too.
I think it was pointed out again today on the press pool that the Republicans are just better at the politicking and at the PR. And so what ends up happening is that They win those branding fights, and I think this was one that they've won for a long time. Democrats want to spend, which, yeah, like Nancy's saying, doesn't really make sense when you look at the fiscal situation historically over presidencies.
Right.
Now that we've all flashed our political knowledge, where do you guys remember when you first became interested in the POTUS press pool?
Yes, I remember exactly. It was in December of 2016. I was, before that, I was a truck driver, so I'm driving around a lot. I listened to my satellite radio a lot, and I found myself in desperate need of a better perspective. I was listened to the Patriot Channel. I listened to Fox News, and that was pretty much it on the talk side, and I just found I needed something better. So I was pressed, went up one channel, and all of a sudden, hey, Julie Mason. And it was like, hey, I like this.
So what appealed to you? It's very rare, I think, for me, in the entire time, in the year that I've done this podcast, I've never come across somebody who went from really being a Patriot and a Fox News listener to a Julie Mason listener. So tell me a little bit, what was it about Fox News and about Patriot Channel that made you feel like you needed a different perspective? And then what was your feeling once you listened to Julie?
Listening to them, I like getting hearing from people who don't have all of the power. So when Barack Obama was president, you know, Republicans and conservatives could just go nuts and say whatever, and anything that he would try and do, they would argue against it, and it was really good to listen to. The moment he wasn't president anymore, there was nothing to argue against, and it was just screaming into the wilderness was all that I heard, and it was just like, I need something better, but I just can't bring myself to listen to progressive talk. I just couldn't, and I found Julie, and it was just like, hey, this is just journalists doing what they do, which is report the news, and I just want to learn things. So it really opened me up, and I was like, okay, hey, let's take a look here.
That's a very encouraging and open-minded way of switching from one, I think it's fair to say, polarized view.
Very polarized.
To something that really tries to be straight down the middle. So that's very encouraging. Nancy, do you remember when POTUS Press Pool came into your life?
No, I don't remember the exact moment. But so I've had satellite radio for a long time, and I was a huge NPR listener. NPR Now, that was just like my only station. They're the ones that I listened to. And I have to say that what happened was the way that the schedule is set up on NPR, like, so you have like Fresh Air in the morning, and then you have the same Fresh Air show so it's the same one at 8 o'clock and 4 o'clock. I'm not sure if the schedule's that way now, but that's the way it was, you know, several years ago. And so I'd be listening on my way to work in the morning, and then I'd want to listen in the afternoon. And I was like, I've already heard this show. I mean, like, how many times can you, you know, hear Terry Gross say the same thing? You know, I mean, like, it's not that interesting to me, you know. And so I said, well, I got to find something else. And I was just, you know, scrolling around, and I had listened to the POTUS channel at some point in time, but I thought that it was like very conservative. I was like, what are they talking about on there? I thought, you know, that's too conservative for me. So I hadn't gotten interested in it. And I just turned on Julie one day, and it had to be like probably like middle, I'm going to say like somewhere in 2015. Like, you know, the election hadn't really like ramped up fully. And, you know, she just made me laugh. Like, you know, she would be talking about serious stuff, you know, but just make me laugh. And I was like, I just need humor in my life. You know, I need some way to look at these, you know, these terrible things that are happening in the world and be okay with it, you know. And, you know, and not to sound too dramatic, but, you know, I think she totally saved me, you know, going through the election, because it was, you know, I definitely, you know, voted for Hillary Clinton, and I definitely did not want Donald Trump to be elected. So I, you know, that was really devastating to me. And I don't think I would have, you know, I mean, I don't think I would, you know, hurt myself or anything, but, you know, it really saved me, you know, listening to her, you know, and particularly, so this is the first time she read one of my tweets on the air. Oh, I thought I won the Oscars or something. I don't, you know. It's like, what? She read it on the air. I called everybody. She read my tweet. She read my tweet on the air. You know, it was great, you know. And then, you know, and she's read a lot of my tweets actually since then, you know. And in fact, when she doesn't read my tweets, I get a little bit like, what did I say? What did I do? That one didn't really hit the mark. You know, I better like do better next time, you know. And one time she even like told me I was in the wilderness or something. She goes, you just sound like you're out in the wilderness. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll work on it. I'll have a better question next time.
Okay, so Nancy keeps being upping her Twitter game.
Yes, I do.
You're just recalibrating and upping. That is that excellent strategy. And since Nancy decided to go straight to the tweeting aspect, Dennis, you have been you're one of those tweeters who there's a few of them. I'm actually not one of them, but Joey Tomatoes is another one who gets a special enunciation every time that their name is read. And yours is Dennis Levesque whenever you're read. So what was that like? When did you start tweeting and how did you like that result once the tweet was read?
I used to tweet a lot and then I went back. This was a couple years ago before I started listening to Julie. I deleted all of my tweets I had because I was I sent some not very nice tweets and I realized, I'm not being a good person. So I kind of stayed away from Twitter for a while, but she kept reading people's tweets. So I thought, well, let's try. And the first time she read one, I had the exact same reaction Nancy did. I got really excited and called my girlfriend. I'm like, my tweet just got read on the radio. And she has no interest in politics, no interest in it, and she's just, okay. And I'm just like, I still, every time mine gets read, I go home and I'm just like, and she just rolls her eyes at me. But I don't even know how the strange pronunciation got for my name, but when I heard it, I was just like, this is awesome, and that's why I've started tweeting a lot more at her, because it's just, I love to hear it.
So that Dennis Levesque really works for you, huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It makes me, same thing Nancy said, though. It's just like, I when I tweet, if I say something, it's just like nothing. I'm just like, all right, gotta do better on the next one. Because it's just, it is a little bit of that high of just like, woohoo, yeah, I said something and it was worthwhile of repeating.
Mm-hmm. Feeling affirmed. Big, big part of the Pooligans lifestyle. Feeling affirmed by being read on satellite radio by Julie Mason is a high that we all enjoy.
Yes.
That is a fact.
Yes.
So I was just gonna add to that too. So my husband and I were traveling last Friday. And we were on the road, and so I was tweeting because I was the passenger, right? So I'm like tweeting, and she read like three of my tweets that, you know, which almost never happens, right? So, you know, so like, and I kept saying, that's me, that's me, she's reading my tweets.
Was he getting progressively more impressed?
No, he's pretty impressed with me anyway, just so you know.
Okay, yeah, well, that's as he should be, of course, as he should be.
Right. But the other thing I was just going to quickly add is that some of the other people, because I listened to Smirkanish and Cuomo and a couple of, you know, who's the other one? Dan Abrams.
Abrams,
the
other
one. You know, and Smirkanish has, like, he has read my tweets. He doesn't read them, but his...
TC does.
And so I've had like over the same period of time, I've had like three tweets. One was read on CNN, which I took a picture of that one. You know, it's like, yay, I've made it. I'm on CNN.
Damn. Oh, she's dropping. Dennis, she is like dropping the hot heat now.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. She was read on CNN. Who are we even?
Yeah, we are nobody now.
Now it's, oh, wow. Okay, please go on. What else?
But, you know, that's what, when that's, I love that about Julie, is that you feel like you are, you know, part of the whole discussion, you know, and in my work, I can come up with pretty good questions. And so I always try to come up with a really interesting question for the roundtable on Friday, you know, and, mm-hmm. and a couple of them have, you know, been really, like, they've really discussed my particular question for a pretty good segment. So I'm like, all right, I try to be part of the discussion in that way. And then just one other tweet thing we're talking about is, like, one day I got upset with one of her guests. I was just like, so, like, yeah, you know, why'd she have this person on there? They're, you know, and I don't even remember what I said, but I wasn't the only one. And, you know, Julie always has sort of like a twinkle in her voice, or, you know, like, she doesn't take mm-hmm. things, you know, too seriously when she's talking about it. She was upset about the tweets, and here's how upset she was. She read my tweet, but she didn't say who I was. She didn't attribute it. But as indicative of, I don't remember who the person was, but that was, I was like, okay, so I'll be better next time, Julie, I promise.
Mm-hmm. You got a little time out there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that can happen. So now that we've talked about this extensively, other than our personal feelings of satisfaction and self-aggrandization of being read on SiriusXM, what keeps you coming back to the POTUS Press Pool on a daily basis? And how do you listen to it? Do you listen to it live? Do you listen to it? Do you have to listen to it later? How do you do your press pooling?
I mean, I can go first if you want. I mostly listen to it live, and but sometimes I don't, or sometimes I will, you know, listen to it kind of on a delay, because I do have work to do, so I might have to take a call or something in between, and then I'll listen to the rest of it.
Annoying.
But one of the things that, you know, you said what keeps me coming back to it is that, just, I would say, the variety of opinions and guests that she chooses to have on there. And I always feel like I've learned something different, and it causes me to question, you know, I never want to be, you know, like I said before, I don't like labels when it comes to politics. And so I don't want to be in a bubble all the time. And I feel like Julie always has, she has such a variety of people every day that she talks to, and some, you know, really fascinating and, you know, interesting people that she's interviewed. And, you know, she interviewed Pete Buttigieg, and she interviewed, I think, mm-hmm. Seth Moulton was one she did recently too, mm-hmm. you know, so yep. It's like just trying to get the information to us, and, you know, and being able to, and the other thing I would say that has always impressed me was the fact that she was a White House correspondent for so long. So I feel like she is almost like an insider, where we wouldn't have known some of those things. Like, she talks about what happens, you know, on those trips when she would, you know, go on Air Force One with, you know, George W. and, you know, and the people, and how things happen in the background. And you don't always get that from other people. So I like listening to it a lot.
Mm-hmm. And no, it's a very unique perspective because of her own experience that she mm-hmm. also brings to it, obviously. Dennis, how about you? What keeps you coming back to the press pool on a daily basis?
First, my consumption of it. If you think a phone call is a little annoying, the way I have to consume the show live is very annoying. As a truck driver, most days I can make anywhere between 5 to 20 stops, and most of mine occur mm-hmm. between 3 and 4. And sometimes you'll go inside to see a customer, and I'm inside there for 15 minutes, so I miss a whole segment. And so I always, the next day, download the previous day's episode, and I listen to that in the morning to make sure I didn't miss anything good.
We are impressed by this level of dedication, Dennis.
Yes.
But what keeps bringing me back is it's the variety. Every day there's something there, and it's not just here's the biggest story today and we're going to talk about it incessantly for hours on end. It's okay, biggest story of the day, we're going to hit on it throughout the program, but here's a bunch of other stuff that you may have missed. And especially as a non-American, it is very useful to me because it's like, oh, hey, there's this going on that's important to hear about. And it really is cool to me as a listener who's not there, doesn't have, you know, a local paper that covers American politics, really. And so it's just a good way to keep myself informed of other things going on.
It sounds like both of you feel like more well-informed listeners after listening to the show. Now, you're in slightly different situations. Nancy has 5 sons and a copious amount of grandchildren. Do you share any of the information that you hear either with your husband or with any of your grandchildren? And how do those discussions go?
Well, the short answer is yes. My husband is, he thinks I watch way too much news, you know, so he's really not that interested in a lot of it, you know. He's and he was a truck driver, by the way, Dennis, for 40 years, so I can relate to what you have to do. But and my children are, my youngest child is 42, so, and he's I probably talk to him the most, only because he calls me, you know, several times a week. And so we're always, having a conversation. I do share with them. I have at least one son that I can't talk any politics with at all because he's a huge Trump supporter. And we just, in the last election, we just, we just can't even talk about that at all because we're just complete polar opposites, you know, of it. And I do share a lot. I was thinking too that, when we talked about the variety on the press pool, I mean, this week, you know, we were talking about Gitmo, about NASA, about, marriage. Like just the variety of topics that, you know, you never feel like, you know, just like you were saying, Dennis, you know, it's not, if you watch CNN, it's, you know, I mean, that the day that the Mueller report came out, it was like, you know, just nonstop, wall to wall, when they didn't even have the report. They just kept talking about it. And I was like, please, you're talking about something that you don't even know what it is, you know. And so luckily we could turn on Julie and it was like, yeah, you know, it's like this breath of fresh air that you know, something different, something new. And so many of those stories are really important to know about what's going on. So I do share a lot with my family, and particularly a couple of my sons that were, you know, I have like the very, very liberal, you know, son, you know, who's way left. And then also my niece and nephew, you know, and we talk too. So, and I try to, if I learn something, I try to impart what I've learned. Like, oh yeah, you know, Obama was no saint. You know, I learned that from Julie. He wasn't a saint. You know, he did things too. So keep that in mind. So I try to inform other people too.
Dennis, how about you? Do you discuss your POTUS press pool experiences with anybody? It doesn't sound like your girlfriend is particularly interested, but anybody else that you talk to, that you talk politics to?
Well, talking politics, if you talk to me for more than about 10 minutes, it's going to come up at some point. I'm usually in the mood to talk about something, but for talking about it, my father in Canada, just so people are aware, the Conservatives have the color blue, Liberals have the color red, and yes, the Liberal Party is called the Liberal Party in Canada. So in my household, when I was a kid growing up, it was my very blue Conservative dad, my very red Liberal mom, And so I talk to them almost every day, and usually politics comes up. And other truck drivers, it is a very common refrain of talk. And so I talk about it every day. I talk about, and you know, with people my own age, because not very many of my friends are highly politically aware, and most that are very liberal. When they need a different perspective, they usually come and ask me, like, hey, where can I get some information about this that isn't, you know, inside of the bubble, because I listen to so many different things.
Have you been able to convert anybody to any Julie listening?
I have converted my dad to Julie listening. He recently started driving the truck again. He was in the office for a little while, and that was dreaded. So he got back into the truck, and I've been pushing Julie on him, and now he listens to her.
Well done, sir. Golf clap for that. Well done. Success story. Okay.
Way to go.
That is fantastic. Yeah, that is fantastic. Now, as far as your social media is concerned, we already talked about your love of things that happen when you tweet something great and it's read. Do you use your Twitter in any other way? Do you use it to talk to any other Pooligans? Have you met any of those people?
Use of Twitter for me is usually used right now to yell at Maxime Bernier supporters in Canada. He's the leader of a new party called the People's Party of Canada. And it is very, very Trumpian, very conservative. And it's populism at its worst. And so I spend most of my Twitter time, if I'm not tweeting at Julie, I'm usually tweeting People's Party of Canada supporters and telling them that I don't think they're very smart for supporting them.
Is that a rising thing? This is, to my shame, I must admit, the first time that I hear about this in very nice Canada. I didn't know that is happening. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Maxime Bernier ran to be the leader of the Conservative Party in Canada. He lost out to the now leader, Andrew Scheer. He wasn't happy about losing. In fact, he was so mad he started his own party. And since then, he's just gone full populist. He's trying to ride a wave. So far, he hasn't been able to get any members elected, but he's trying. And we do have a federal election in October, so he might yet get somebody else in there. But the big hoopla this week with him is his comments about transgendered individuals, and he's causing a bit of an uprising about that, because it's hard to tell why, because anytime you talk to somebody, they change what the point is, but more or less he thinks that you should be able to call a trans person by whatever they're transitioning away from. And it's just, it's inane, it's stupid, and it's just, you know, a lot of, if a person decides they want to transition, you call them by what they want to be called. It's pretty simple. I don't understand why it's so hard for some people.
I think it's mostly that homophobia sells to a particular segment of voters, no? Or transphobia in this case.
Homophobia, transphobia.
Whatever else phobia. Phobia sells, I believe, in general.
Yeah, and it's finding a very ripe home here in Canada, unfortunately. We don't have, you know, we like to think, oh, you know, we're the better neighbor, because, you know, we didn't have slavery, even though you just have to ignore Halifax. But, sorry. But, like, true. People seem to think that, oh, we're better than the Americans, that's a common thing here, is like, you know, we're not great, but we're better than there. And a lot of times you just got to stop, because people don't even know our own history. Most Canadians know more American history than they do Canadian. It's really sad. Yeah. And you have to really stop people and explain to them why they are so wrong.
So that was some Canada insight here for you.
Yeah.
Nancy, how about you? How do you use your Twitter for any news reading? Have you met any other? I know you've met other Pooligans, so don't even try to deny that. But how do you interact with your Twitter, and how has that been for you?
Yeah, I use Twitter a lot, actually. In fact, one day I had to like take a Twitter break. I was like, yeah, I'm not going on Twitter today because I really am on it.
What?
A lot.
Oh my God.
Right? You know, I took a day off.
Unthinkable.
Right? I know. But the I follow a lot of the news people, and you know, the people that come on the, you know, on the press pool, I tend to, like, I always, like, look them up when she gives their Twitter name, and I follow them. I do read a lot of stories on Twitter. you know, and then follow those stories, you know, where they go. Probably, that's probably like a big part of my, you know, where I get news. And then I, you know, and then I'll look things up too, if I think it, well, that just sounds silly or whatever it is. And I, you know, I don't just believe everything because it was on Twitter, you know.
Yes, that is a great idea. Dear audience, please adhere to that particular maxim. Yeah. Do not believe everything that it says on Twitter. Right. You will be a terrible, terribly misinformed person in short order.
But, you know, like I get notifications from, you know, Julie, but also from like Isaac Dover. And I'm right now I'm fascinated with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I get. But she tweets a lot, so I think I have to like maybe back, you know, because it's like, you know, I get like 40 notifications a day of something that she's tweeted, so I want to try and move away from that. I used to like try to argue with people, you know, like I would, and like I said, I'm pretty good at coming up with questions. So when people post something that I think is, you know, kind of silly, or, you know, I call them Trump acolytes when they do that. You know, I try to ask a question of like, you know, oh yeah, what has he really done for you? You know, or how are you, where did you get that information? Or can you share more about that? Can you tell me more about, you know, you're posting these, you know, things that sound like they're, you know, complete, you know, truths when they're really not, you know. And so I try to look at it.
What kind of replies do you get on those occasions?
Oh, you know, I have been called every nasty name that you can imagine. You know, I've been called a libtard, a snowflake, you know, and then I find that like if they don't really have a good rebuttal or a good argument for what they're saying, then somehow I'm stupid. You know, oh, you say that, you must be the most ignorant person ever. And I used to block people a lot on Twitter, but I find it's actually, this is sort of my guilty pleasure, is that I mute them, which means I can still say nasty things to them, but I don't see what they say.
So, excellent strategy. I recommend it to everyone. The mute button is so much fun. They are raging and they are absolutely going insane. You can't hear any of it. It's beautiful.
I know. It is. And the
strong recommend.
And the other thing I want to say too is that I had to buy a new cell phone, which I think I might have, you know, some of the Pooligans know this, right? I had to buy a new cell phone and I lost my password to Twitter. And I did everything in the world to get it back and I couldn't get it back. So I just created a new account that has a slightly different spelling of my Twitter handle.
I was wondering how that happened.
Yep. Yeah. And then somebody, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, then somebody was like tracking me, and because I was trying to like get my Twitter followers back, and so I was like following a lot of people, and within like a few weeks I had gone from 0 to 700 followers, right? And this person said that they were trying to make out that I was some kind of a fake account and that he was going to investigate me. That person I blocked. You're laughing because I'm thinking, did this happen to either of you?
No, I'm always very entertained by the Sherlock Holmeses of Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, they come in, they're like, I have just noticed that you are probably a bot account, and I will prove it because I can.
What I don't get about that is, why does it matter? If you think somebody's a bot, why do you care? Right. Report it, go away, if that's what you think. Why are you bothering with any of the rest of that? Like, what is going on in your life that is what you need to do right this second?
Not a lot is the answer to that question. Right. That is the smallest battles on the tiniest hills to die on.
I try to be kind, you know, because I am basically a kind person. And even if I'm upset with somebody, I try to just, you know, like, you know, I can't be bothered with, I can't be bothered with them. You know, I mean, like, they're not worth my time. That's the way I look at it.
Now, contrary to the people who are not worth your time, how about those Pooligans, though?
I follow a lot of Pooligans, I'm sure. You know, I don't know them. I mean, I know you and Bubbles, and there's a couple of other people. And Dennis and I just met you, so, you know, and I actually went in and followed you while we were talking. So.
Yeah, I unfortunately wasn't following you prior to, and I just started following everybody. Actually, I asked Julie one day, not during show hours. I just sent a message thinking maybe somebody will, maybe she'll give me an answer or say, hey, pay attention to this. Because I asked for cheese recommendations. And oh my God, she replied and brought everybody into it. And I got so many messages and suggestions. I was just like, this is awesome. And that's when I started really following other Pooligans. And it's quite cool to start to get involved into this community.
Yeah, no, that's a stone cold hack, by the way. If you want every Pooligan's attention, you literally ask for cheese recommendations and it will rain down Pooligans from every possible angle.
Oh yeah, that it definitely did. And it was, I realized afterwards that was a very good play on my behalf. But at the time I was just thinking, a message into the abyss.
Right.
Well, I'm glad. Have you had time to try any of these cheese recommendations, Dennis?
Yes, I did. I had a cheese. It was my first cheese party I've ever done. Oh, wow. I had a couple of friends over, and we had five different cheeses. We had four different wines, and it was a very successful night. And none of my friends had ever done it. You know, we're all young. Most of my friends still want to go to a bar most nights, so. It was a very big change of pace for us, but it was a very big success.
That is so lovely to hear. So everybody who commented on Dennis's what should I serve these people for my first cheese party thread, well done. Well done, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, thank you
all. It worked. That is fantastic. Do either one of you use any other social media? Are you Facebooky at all, or is that, I know for millennials Facebook ain't that cool no more, but is either one of you Facebooky?
I use Facebook, and it's mostly because I have all these children, grandchildren, you know, and so there's always lots of pictures and things. In the leading up to the 2016 election, I was like very actively, you know, posting and, you know, political things, but I don't do that anymore because it's just on Facebook. It's just not the same. You know what I mean? Like, people get really angry, you know, and when they're related to you, it's kind of hard to get over it. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, like we were talking about, like, you know, muting people on Twitter, you know, but on Facebook, yeah, it's a lot harder because they know who you are, you know, and they know where you live.
Oof, yeah, tough combination. Right, right. Bad setup.
Yeah.
I am a Facebook user. I haven't shunned it yet. A lot of my friends, we all use Facebook, and I really like, I use Facebook in a very different way than I use Twitter, because Facebook is very much so that is where I post things that I want my friends and family, very close people to me. This is like, hey, here's what I'm doing right now, here's where I am, or here's something cool that I want you guys to see. Whereas Twitter is very much so just kind of a place for me to try and engage with other people, or at least see what's going on outside of my little personal bubble.
Okay.
Very different setup.
You're surprisingly Facebooky in that case.
Yes.
See, this show is always a surprise. Either one of you have any favorite press pool moments or guests? Deep inhale by both. I would like to say, in case you couldn't hear it.
Yeah, I would say I always love when she has Major Garrett on there. I don't know what it is. I just like him. He has this sort of a. Well, I mean, I watch him on CBS too, and he has this sort of a. It's not snarky, but it's
handsomeness.
There's just something about him, you know, and he's Very smart, you know. I like any time when Julie talks about all of us being so wicked smart, you know, when she calls them, you know, when she says that. So I like that. But I, in preparation for this, I actually wrote something down about, you know, when you talk about a favorite moment, was there was a question that
you have a prepared statement.
I got my teleprompter here. Let me just get this going. Right.
So, nice.
Right. So it was on the round table, and I don't remember who the three reporters were, but my question to them was, what question would you most like to ask Donald Trump? And the best answer was that, one of them said they wanted to asked Donald Trump what he wanted his legacy to be. Did he actually want to have a legacy, or did he just want his legacy to be tearing down Obama's legacy? And that, you know, I was like, wow, that was really something, you know, that question. So that was one of my favorite moments.
My favorite guest would have to be Siraj. I love when she has him on and they just beat up on millennials, and it is very, very amusing to listen to. I actually really enjoy it. I things that they say, I always use with my friends to rile them up. It's very effective, so I love when Siraj is on. I don't really have a favorite moment, though. I just like listening and having all of the discussions that go on around it.
Mm-hmm. No, that is completely legit. And with that, we are done with our questionnaire and are now coming to the freeform part of this exercise, which will not be as free as previously anticipated, because some stuff came up as we chatted about doing this episode. One amazing statistic that you all may not yet be aware of is, Nancy, how many of the United States have you been to?
46.
46. So question number one, what did the four remaining states do wrong to not be in consideration?
Well, if I tell you what they are, then it might make sense, right?
Yes, yes, go ahead.
It's both of the Dakotas. I've never been to North or South Dakota. And
okay, why does that make sense? Wait, hold on.
Why does that make sense?
What did the Dakotas do?
What did they do? They just, it's not what they did, it's what they haven't done. They haven't done anything to really entice me to want to be there, other than Mount Rushmore. There's not a whole lot there.
Other than Mount Rushmore, yeah, that little thing that nobody wants to see, okay.
And the other two states are Indiana and Iowa.
Indiana and Iowa, okay. These are not at all the states that I anticipated.
Which ones did you anticipate?
I don't know. I thought it would be like something exotic. Like, I don't know. I haven't been to Alaska, or I haven't been to...
I've actually lived in Alaska, and my youngest son was actually born there.
See, this is why I do a podcast and am not on SiriusXM.
Whereabouts in Alaska was it you lived?
I lived in Anchorage. I lived in Kodiak for a year on the island Kodiak, and I lived in Eagle River, Alaska, which is outside of Anchorage.
Did you hear our episode with our Alaskan fisherman?
No, I didn't, but I will go back and listen to that one for sure.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one with Andy the fisherman. Yeah, that's a great episode. We had a long talk about the beauty of Alaska. And
Alaska is very beautiful.
I still haven't been and I'm dying to go. But anyway, since this is not a podcast about me, tell us about your favorite states and your least favorite states that you have visited out of those 46.
Okay. All right. My favorite state to live in is actually New Jersey. I know that surprises people. New Jersey, because that doesn't sound like
that surprises people. Yes.
Yeah, and
I'm a people. I'm very surprised right now.
Well, and there is a reason, right? So the thing about New Jersey that's kind of a hidden secret is that it's very diverse, and it's you know, where we lived was probably less than an hour from New York City. So you could get into New York City and do mm-hmm. things and go to Broadway shows and do those kinds of things. Where I lived, there was hiking and mountains. And there's also, you know, there's the Jersey Shore. So there's beaches. And you're probably, you know, less than an hour from Philadelphia. So you can go there and, you know, see all the historical sites in Philadelphia. So New Jersey is kind of a hidden gem, but very expensive. So I live in Virginia right now, but I wouldn't go back to live in New Jersey just because of how expensive it is. But it's kind of one of my favorite. And you asked my least favorite. And I want to say that I don't really have a least favorite. I think that, you know, all the rest of the state, maybe
Wyoming. Sounds like a political answer.
Yeah, that's a pretty big cop-out right there.
Yeah, it's a totally political answer. It's not all appreciated at all.
But I was going to say, maybe Wyoming has the biggest mosquitoes in the world. You know, well, Alaska has pretty big mosquitoes. I remember being in Wyoming and we were camping, which I don't ever do anymore. I gave that up. But we were camping. And,
because of Wyoming?
Yeah, it could be, yes. Because we were, we had to get out of the camper and you had to run like crazy to get to the, you know, where the bathrooms were, because you'd just be bombarded with hundreds of mosquitoes, you know? And I was like, who comes here on purpose? You know, I mean, like, this is like not even fun.
Okay. So, well, there we go. Fuck you, Wyoming, and your huge, huge mosquitoes. So they were not only were they numerous, but they were also large in size.
Very large, yes.
Oof, that's a terrible. That sounds terrible. That's like my nightmare of camping. This is why I don't camp.
I'm right there with you.
One never know when you're being accosted by giant Wyoming mosquitoes on your run to the bathroom just to do your daily business. That's just terrible. What a nightmare. Dennis, have you been? You've been to quite a few states. Yes.
Yes, I have been to 24 of the 50 so far.
Have you been to Wyoming and have you met any large mosquitoes?
No, unfortunately, I did not make it that far west. I made it to Nebraska, but I did not meet these giant mosquitoes.
Regrettable. They sound endearing. Do you have any, tell us your favorite and least favorite places in Canada first, to be fair, and then maybe in the United States.
My favorite place in Canada to be is pretty easy for me. It's out in New Brunswick. It's where my French family is from. We're Acadian. We are not Quebecois. Very, very big distinction between the two. But I'm very fond of it. You get out there, it's mountains and moose and sea. And I've been out there a couple of times now. Just love it. And I can't wait to go live there and be a hermit in a little cabin on the side of a mountain. But least favorite place in Canada is probably Toronto. And I make it very specific to that city because everything about it is terrible. Because everything that is good in Ontario is there. Like, as far as city-wise is concerned, it's where the best museums are, best sports stadiums. So you have to go there, but unfortunately there's 3 million and some odd other people living there. So it's just hell to get around.
I see. You would really enjoy Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's super, super fun in that respect. I was going to ask you, my grandfather in the 60s built a car silo in Toronto. And so because that was the first car silo in Toronto, he lived there for a while. And he always said that Toronto was his favorite city in the world. And to my shame, to this day, I've never made it to Toronto, even though you would have figured that I would have done that by now. But you're saying that it's not a great city based on the fact that you don't enjoy being around that many people, seeing how your dream is to be a hermit in a small cabin? Or are you saying it because you just specifically find something disturbing about Toronto?
It's an Ontario thing. Anybody who's not from Toronto and doesn't love that city it's just a thing where everybody hates it. It's just one of those things. But as far as the city goes, to be a tourist in that city is lovely. They have great they have great things for you to go look at, great historical sites. There's plenty of great parks. There's waterfront right there. Right there is Lake Ontario, so it's beautiful. But as far as living, I lived on one of the outer suburbs of Toronto for a little while, and I just couldn't stand living there. It was just too many people, too much going on. But as far as visiting goes, definitely would recommend going.
All right, so we softened that a little bit. Now, how about the United States? Do you have any favorite places in the United States that you've been to?
My favorite places, it's a toss-up between Louisiana and South Carolina. Louisiana, because the long-kicked-out Acadians went down there, and they're now known as the Cajuns. And I love going down there and seeing the French culture in the U.S., and getting to interact with people down there. It's lovely. I can't wait to go back to New Orleans and Baton Rouge really get some more time down there. And South Carolina, just because it was so calm. It was, when I went there, it was the middle of summer. It was a beautiful day and just nice cool breeze, and everybody just seemed pretty relaxed. Nobody was in a big rush. It would just seem like a very lovely place, and I wish I got to spend more time there.
I'm getting the vibe that you like the more laid-back, relaxed nature places rather than the fast metropolis setting. Am I reading this right?
Very much so. I grew up in what is one of the, I think it's the 20th or 18th largest city in Canada, and it's 300,000 people. And as soon as I got away from it and went to someplace smaller, I was much happier. And yeah, it's been that way ever since.
I get it. And speaking of really small places where not a lot of people go, Disney World. so have you been to Disney World, Dennis?
Now, there's Disney World and Disneyland. Which is the one in Florida?
Disney World.
Disney World. Then yes, I've been to Disney World.
Despite your sort of reticence about being in places where lots of people are running around, you've been to Disney World.
Yes, my parents took me when I was a kid. That was one of the biggest.
You had no say.
Yeah.
Got it.
Well, actually, you know what? As a kid, I loved it. The memories that I have from being down there are amazing. And my girlfriend that I'm with now, she has a boy. I would love to be able, in a few years, he's a little too young for it now. In a few years, I would love to be able to take him down and to have him experience it, because it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. No, it's definitely totally the happiest place on earth. Nancy, please tell us about your Disney Worlding.
My Disney Worlding. So, yeah, I went there like the first year that it opened, and I just like really, I fell in love with it, you know, and I just, the whole concept of, you know, how they put it together, it's very, you know, this sounds kind of funny, but it's very clean there, you know, because they really like cleaned it up a lot. You know, and you know, I love Space Mountain. I love the Hall of the Presidents. That's one of my favorite places to go to and see they have that movie, and then at the end of the movie they have the, I don't know if it's still the same movie, but the one where they show the rocket. It's the Saturn V that took the astronauts to the moon. Right. So, you know, it to me, it just like sparks so much imagination and energy. And my favorite part of Disney World is really Epcot Center, because it's, you know, I love going around all the worlds. And I have some, one granddaughter, we went there, she and her sister, they were like 3.5 and 4.5, and we lost her at Disney World. And it was one of those, you know, really things that, you know, took like 10 years off my life, you know. And we of course found her, you know, because otherwise it would be a very tragic story, you know. And then the funny thing is, my husband said, "Do we tell her mother?" Because her mother was very like overprotective. "Do we tell her mother?" And I was like, "Of course,
she knows now."
I was like, "We have to tell her because she will tell her." You know, she wasn't small enough to not remember what happened to her.
Listen, sweetheart, you can have this lollipop as long as you don't tell your mom that we just lost you at Disney World. Right. We can count on you, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. That always goes well.
Yeah, that didn't work. So, mm-hmm. And I love telling those stories too. And this is my, I don't mind telling you how old I am. This is my 70th birthday in September. And
congratulations early.
Believe me, the other day I said, "Oh my goodness, I'm going to be a septuagenarian. I didn't even know I could spell that word, much less be that, you know."
7 years, the new 50.
Yes, thank you. I'll go with that, right? Mm-hmm. And so I want to go to Disney World. So I'm, you know, I rented a villa down there, and we're just going to have fun and go around and, you know, go to the small world or go to something.
I remember my first time at Disney World because I grew up in Switzerland. And so Switzerland had one amusement park that was close enough to our home to actually travel to, which is across the border in Germany, called Europa Park, which is now a crazy, crazy thing, which has like the highest rated roller coasters in the world. Oh, wow. But at the time, it definitely did not have the highest rated roller coasters at the time. It just had sad little versions of whatever they had seen at Disneyland. But sad and depressing and in German. It was awful. I came home. I was like, "We're going to an amusement park." And then we came there and they had a version of Space Mountain. Uh-huh. And you know, Nancy, you're familiar with Space Mountain, yeah, like historically over time. So you know it was, at the beginning, also not the most thrilling roller coaster in the world, necessarily. But it was cool because it was, you know, it's dark and it's fun.
Yeah.
They had it. It was about a third the size. They tried to make it dark, but it was not dark enough to where it was actually dark. So you could see that you were just in an embarrassingly small space on an embarrassingly small roller coaster. So it was just silence in darkness. Nobody screamed because it was embarrassing. And you're just silent in darkness until it's over. And then you just get out. And your parent is like, "That was fun, right?" And you're like, "Are you fucking kidding me right now? That was awful. But when the first time we... So after that experience, after that early informative experience... The first time at Disney World, I think, was part of, other than seeing New York and at some point seeing Hawaii a year later, which changed my perception of what the world could actually be like. But Disney World, to me, was one of those things where everything that I had seen in movies about America was confirmed in one space.
Wow.
Everything was clearly more fun, more joyful, more perfect and more entertaining than anything we had in Switzerland ever. And there were Dancing Mouse and Goofy, and it was amazing. And then the lake for me was also amazing. I was like, "Oh yeah, that is a small Germany. I get it." But they don't have all the bad parts, they just have pretzels. This is fantastic. Pretzels and sausages, you have everything, and a few buildings and people in lederhosen, and everything's great. This is fantastic. Best place ever.
It is, you know. And my I remember my youngest son, when he was like 18 months old, we went to Disney World, and we were standing in the line for It's a Small World, and he was just screaming the whole time, like he didn't want to go into the small world. And I was like, and you know, you're like waiting in these really long lines. You're like, "You're going in." Like, "I'm not going to," you know, and the people in front of me, and I was like making jokes like, "Yeah, you know, torture your children, take them to Disney World." They don't know what they want. And when we got inside in the boat, as soon as like the doors opened up, his like eyes got like huge saucers, and he was just like watching it, and he was all like completely entranced the whole way around with that crazy song that, you know, you can't get out of your head for days. And then when we came out of it, he just looked at me, he said, "Can we do that again?" And I just was like, you tortured me for 45 minutes before we got in there, and now you want to do it again, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
That's how Disneyland works, and Disney World
that's
as well.
That's how it works.
Dennis, yeah. Dennis, did you have any favorite rides? Do you remember anything about it?
I remember it was... I'm trying to remember what exactly it was. It was a combination of a movie and live action. It was with the Muppets, I think is what they're called, or whatever it is. But there, it was... I just remember it was a ton of fun. There's not a lot I remember specifically other than we wanted to go on the monorail that goes around, and my dad got us into this line, and me and my brother, we were both like, this is not the right line. This is going into something we don't want to. Neither me and my brother were very big fans of scary things, especially as young kids. Mm-hmm. And, we're in line the whole time. We're just like, yeah, this is the wrong line. This isn't it. This isn't it. We get into this thing, and I don't know what it was from or what. You get sat down in these chairs. Bars come across. There's a guy. He was doing some performance thing. There's a monster locked in a center container, and then it breaks out. And then they have the thing has breath going down across your back. Somebody, people walking around grabbing you. And I just remember as a small kid, I was terrified. And when we got out, I was mad at my dad, and I did not speak to him for the rest of the time. I was just like, I told you. And there's nothing worse than a small child who was right about something and will not let you forget it.
You're 100% right. That happened to me when I took my children to the Harry Potter part of Universal in Florida, and we went on the Harry Potter ride at like 5 a.m. and the Dementors floated up right next to my kid and next to my little boy, who at the time was maybe 7, I would say, and I've never seen him afraid for his life other than in that moment, and he was absolutely petrified, and I felt terrible. I was like holding his hand. He gripped me so hard. And it was the same thing that you just said. It was because the Dementor's coat had brushed against his leg.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely traumatized. So the next day, we made everybody buy the magic wands. And we went back on the ride the next day with the magic wands. And when the Dementors came out, we all like screamed the anti-Dementor spell. So everybody screamed. Everybody screamed the anti Expecto Patronus. Uh-huh. So everybody was like, Expecto Patronus, and it was like a liberating experience for him, because then it was over and he felt like he was in control. And then you kind of float through that ride, so the cart kind of kept floating, and then we could hear the next cart behind us scream, Expecto Patronus. We were like, yes. We have done something good today. Yeah. But I'm sorry that happened to you, Dennis, because he still remembers it. He's now 13 and will be very angry that I just told this story. Uh-huh. But he still remembers that moment.
It's really funny how stuff like that will stick with you, though, because there's very, like, I know I went there. There's a lot of things I can remember roughly. I can remember standing in line a lot. But some of that whole thing, I can still picture, if I close my eyes, I can still picture being sat in that chair and feeling myself get grabbed. And it was really weird. But I would love to go back so that way there I could really experience it better now. Plus the yeah. Harry Potter stuff would be a lot of fun.
It's so, the Harry Potter stuff is like the best. Have you been to the Harry Potter stuff, Nancy?
No, we're definitely going to do that. You know, have you guys remember the haunted house, the haunted mansion mm-hmm. at Disney World?
Mm-hmm.
Because one time when I was there, so I had like my two older children were sitting in the car behind us, and I had my youngest in the car with me. and we're going through the Haunted Mansion, and all of a sudden they stop the whole ride and they say, the spirits are acting up, you know. And then when we got out, and then, you know, when we got out, I found out the spirits were my two older children who, when it slowed down, they got out of the cart inside the ride.
Wow. So somebody had to Ghostbuster your children out of the out of the Haunted Mansion.
Yeah. You know, and because it's that big chair and you can't see, you know, behind you what's going on behind you. I didn't know what they were doing. I was like, oh, can't take you guys anywhere.
What were they? Did they tell you what they were trying to do?
They were just trying to be, you know, they just got out. They wanted to, like, you know, it was the part where you're kind of going through a graveyard, you know, there's sort of like a graveyard in the middle, and they just wanted to get out and see what would happen. I think they just made them get back in the car, because I didn't know anything about it until after we got out. The kids are the ones who told me. They're like, oh, yeah, we got out of the car. I'm like, what? What were you thinking?
That's amazing. I guess in my fantasies, there were much stricter rules against misbehaving like that at Disney World. I expected like lights and armed guards and and handcuffs. But
you know, I can also imagine that maybe when they got out, you know, and then so the ride was stopped. And then they, you know, maybe they realized that, oh, yeah, we're going to get in trouble. And they hopped back in. So maybe the guards or people didn't know who got out.
Yeah, I spent 2 hours once in It's a Small World. My older child is still traumatized by this experience. The ride broke down, and it was literally 2 hours. And then, so finally they were like, you know what, we're actually going to turn off the music. So they turned off the music. And now it's just hundreds of puppets staring at you silently.
Oh, my goodness.
How long did it take before you just wanted to kill them all?
Yeah, it was one of those moments where, you know, in a former career, I was making horror movies, and I was like, you know, I can totally see how this could absolutely lend itself to a horror movie right now. This is the setup. All these little guys are going to get little knives that they have stacked behind them, and then they'll just start jumping at the little boats, at the gondolas.
Bride of Chucky, right?
Exactly. Yeah. International Children's Community of Chucky.
Yeah, right.
Super scary. Hey, guys who make Chucky, if you need a pitch for a new story, here it is.
You just need to make sure that the French ones have baguettes instead of knives.
We were right, running toward the French. Or the Dutch with their Gouda wheels. And speaking of things that are totally hilarious, some current politics. Tell me really quickly. I'm known, by the way, I don't know whether you knew this, for my smooth transitions. This was one of those.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they're top notch. Do you guys have any feelings about current politics that you would like to share with the audience?
Something I would like to share is, please make sure to all the American listeners, please make sure you contact all of your representatives and make sure that nothing happens to the trade deals. That, I am very biased with that. I'm a truck driver. My job is dependent upon that border being open. Anything that happens to that border affects my job. My freight levels have been down since he became president, in large part due to trade uncertainty. People don't want to send stuff across the border if they're worried about it costing more. So that is a big thing that I would say right now is, trade is a big issue. Make sure you stay on your representatives to keep on Trump about it. You can't just pull out of the North American Free Trade Agreement or the new USMCA.
Would the new one benefit or hurt your industry or your work in any specific way?
It would benefit us. Anything that is done to increase trade is going to be better for us. Some of the, especially for Canadians, the rules about minimum wage payments and auto worker pay in Mexico will really affect Canada, because most of those jobs that leave Mexico, a lot of those jobs will come to Canada. They won't go back to the US. They will come to Canada because we are still a cheaper place for them to make parts. The assembling the cars usually stays in the United States because you want those cars coming off an assembly line in the US for the marketing appeal. But a lot of parts are made in Canada, and with that, more parts will be made here.
Thank you for that, because I didn't really, you know, I mean, I hear a lot about the trade deals and the, you know, the tariffs and stuff like that. But it's good for me to know, you know, how it's really affecting people and who it really affects. So I wrote that note down. I am going to call my representative about it.
So would you say that the USMCA is actually looked upon favorably in Canada as an alternative to NAFTA?
For the most part, from everything that's come out, it's kind of, okay. The agreement that is made is actually less favorable than the new trade deal would have been if the United States had entered TPP. Mm. A lot of the issues that came up, a lot of the auto stuff... dairy, cheese, milk, all of that stuff was dealt with in TPP, and you guys would have had better deal with Canada had you entered TPP than this renegotiated deal.
Yeah, unfortunately, TPP was favored by Obama, so clearly that could not happen, and we needed something new named after the U.S. Marine Corps, which then needed to add an A in order not to be so confusing as to just have the same exact acronym. But the TPP, I think, is one of those things that is vastly misunderstood by a large part, or the majority, I would say, probably of the United States.
And for us right now, TPP is huge. In Canada, China is starting to cut off our trade because we agreed to arrest the CFO of Huawei. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. I can't remember her name, and it's bugging me that I can't. But because we arrested her, China has been taking punitive actions against us. They've rejected our soy because they're saying it's contaminated with a bug that cannot live in our climate, which is kind of funny. And just over the weekend, they refused entry to our pork products now. So the TPP is coming in huge for us because we're now sending those goods. We're going to be trying to send them to more Asian markets because we now have a better trade deal with them. So for us, it's huge, especially right now, since we are standing with the U.S. and with the rule of law on arresting the Huawei executive. But we're definitely caught in the game right now that's being played between the U.S. and China, because it's having a huge effect on our farmers and our industries.
And something I think that we have not really discussed on this podcast, I need to make a note to discuss that more. Maybe I'll finally reach out and see if I can get Tony Frato on this podcast to talk about all things economics. It would make me a lot smarter. Okay. And I think could be a really interesting conversation.
That would be an amazing one.
Nancy, do you have anything that you would like to talk about still? Anything in your craw?
Yeah, well, I mean, what goes back to me is that, you know, over 100 million people didn't vote in the 2016 who were eligible election. And it really bothers me that people don't take it seriously in our country, you know. And, you know, if people would go to Arlington Cemetery and see all the headstones that all of those people died for us to have the freedom to be able to vote. And, you know, and we should try and honor that. I don't understand why people stay home and don't vote, that they, you know, because they certainly stand in line to go to see Avengers Endgame. So, you know, how about going to exercise your not just your right, but it's also a responsibility, you know, to vote. So I'm encourage people to, you know, if you are someone who votes, consistently, then get your neighbors to vote, help with registration. And I don't, personally, I don't care what somebody's, who they vote for. you know, because in the end, if, you know, if 90% of the eligible voters in the United States elected Donald Trump, then I can live with that. But when it's 42% or 46 or whatever it was that he got, 46% of less than 50%, you know, who actually elected him, I find that really hard to live with. And we know that most of the people in the United States, you know, have more socially liberal views. And the things that, you know, keep, you know, happening, like what they're doing with the abortion laws and what they're doing with transgender rights and LGBTQ rights and, you know, all of the things that they keep trying to do away with, it's because people aren't getting out there and voting those people out of office. And so that's the only way to, it's the only way your voice will be heard. That's the only, you know, it's better than impeachment. It's better than anything. Just vote these people out of office so that the majority of the citizens of the United States are being heard. So that's what sticks in my craw. Yeah, and I don't know if either of you saw this, but there's a, I think it was a state senator in Texas just introduced a bill that would restrict people from driving other people to the polls. That, like, you can't drive somebody else to to vote. You know, so no buses, because we know that like 3 million illegals were bused to the polls to vote in 2016.
It says a lot about a candidate or a person running for an office when you just want less people to vote. That says a lot about what you think about your about what you can do.
Exactly. You know, it's like I can live with the result if I feel that, you know, I do believe in democracy, you know, so I can live with the result if you know, if that really is what the majority rule says. But, you know, when half the people stay home, you know, I don't understand it, you know. I mean, people died so that I could have the right to vote.
I think in Canada, we have a unique thing where our voter turnout is largely dependent upon when an election is called in big parts. Springtime and summer elections, you get much better turnout. When it's, you know, February and it's minus 30 and there's 5 feet of snow out front your door, it's a little hard to go vote. So politicians, when they decide to hold an election, whether it be summer or winter, makes a huge difference in our country. But things like that, it's just, it's insane to us.
We have been at this for a while. Are there any last thoughts that anybody would like to share with the listenership?
I'll go first then.
Go ahead.
I just want to say thank you for allowing me on here and to let me express some of my views. It's very cool that there's this community that follows politics this closely and is open enough to have people of different varieties be accepted. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you for coming on, sir. It's really been fun. And I'm sure that a lot of people will start following our friend Dennis Levesque at DeNisaur. You now know why he has this Twitter handle. And Nancy, of course, you will follow if you're not don't already, which many of you do, at NARDWIEN. Follow her now. As you heard, she had to change Twitter accounts thanks to a lost password. So if you've lost track of her, follow her again at Nardween.
And I just wanted to also thank you, Daniel, for doing the Pooligans podcast and for keeping after me. My reluctance was really out of sort of fear of speaking, you know, out loud.
Fear of speaking.
Fear of speaking.
Okay, well, it turns out it's not something you're particularly bad at, Nancy, so I don't know what the hesitance was, but please never be afraid of speaking again.
Okay, I will keep that in mind. But thank you for that, and I really appreciate it. And so nice that I got to be on with someone that I didn't, you know, I hadn't really known before. So it's nice to know you, Dennis, and to get to know you, Daniel, better too. So I appreciate it very much.
Oh, thank you very much. And with that, my dear friends, that is it for this Meet the Pooligans episode. We will be back soon with another one. But for now, I thank my guests very much, and we'll see you next time.